This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Two cousins of convicted murderer Barton McNeil are trying to fight for the freedom of a relative they believe wrongly convicted.
The neighbors all told me they thought Masuk was going to do something. He moved over there and they knew it to get away from her.
Hear about the sleuthing of Grace Schlaffler and Chris Ross during our ongoing presentation of the podcast Suspect Convictions. Central Illinois Congressman Rodney Davis approves of the hardline foreign policy and rhetoric of President Trump. Davis talks with GLT's Ryan Denham. And IWU alum and actor Richard Jenkins is up for a Golden Globe this weekend. GLT's Judy Valente talks with Jenkins about his career. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's January 5th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. GLT listeners will hear these words for the final time today.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
After 30 years of hosting All Things Considered and more than 40 years at NPR, Robert Siegel is retiring. Illinois Public Radio's Brian Moline spoke with Robert Siegel from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. about his career at NPR and what led him to pursue a career in radio news.
I was in college. I had enjoyed working at the college radio station a lot, doing, you know, some reading, some newscasts, but for the most part, fooling around. And at the end of college, in my last semester, there were enormous protests at Columbia University in New York. And the demonstrations were a big nationwide story. And we at the college radio station said, well, we should probably cover this. And we produced this thing, and I anchored it. And at a time of great confusion, at a time when the normal source of order was upended and students were occupying buildings and professors were outside of buildings instead of inside of them, we on the radio station were a source of some clarity. We answered people's questions about what was going on through our reporting. And I felt, wow, in this time of tumult and confusion, for me to be doing something useful, of service to people, and I also get to know what's going on. It satisfies my curiosity. And I'm not an activist. I'm kind of a professional spectator and interpreter of this. If I could do this for a living, this would be amazing. And astonishingly, that's what I've been able to do.
Do you feel like maybe you've come full circle in some ways with some of the turmoil and tumult of our political scene right now?
Well, it's not a circle. It's not a circle. I think it's a much more jagged line because in the course of my working life, I've seen, I went to Poland in 1981 a couple of times on brief reporting trips, and I saw an entire country in the kind of disorder, upheaval, uncertainty, a mixture of elation and fear that I had remembered from these big college protests. I was in New York for 9/11. I got to Berlin for the wall to come down. And there are always moments of great change. It's not in the nature of humanity for things to be constant and always to be certain. So what we're going through now in Washington with the Trump presidency, which is certainly unusual and certainly marks a different relationship between the president and the news media than what we've been accustomed to, change is the one thing we can assume is constant. And newness is what we shouldn't, we can't describe it in advance, but we shouldn't be shocked by it when we see it.
Looking back at when you joined NPR in 1976, how did the network fit into the news landscape at that time?
It's interesting. It was a very small outfit. We had about 10 reporters in total. when I came, people were very proud that NPR had broadcast live the entire Watergate hearings and the entire impeachment hearings. So that was at a time when commercial radio was backing away from an investment in news and current affairs. We were on FM radio, and a lot of people in America still didn't have an FM radio, frankly. Most cars, it wasn't standard equipment in a car. So our typical station, not all of them, but the majority of our stations were on a band that people were moving to. The trend was toward FM, but a lot of people couldn't hear us yet. The big program we did was All Things Considered, 90 minutes long, starting at 5 p.m. Eastern. And it had some fresh reporting of the day's events in Congress and at the Supreme Court by Nina Totenberg and at the White House. But to a great extent, it was a gloss on things that had been reported earlier in the big papers, in the Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. And we were giving you more and more analysis of an expert commentary on news events that other people had reported. And that steadily has changed over the year to a much greater role of us being the primary news source, but still being a news source, a source of other people's reporting and what it means. But the balance has shifted enormously over these years.
Before you began hosting All Things Considered, you had several other roles with the network. You opened NPR's London Bureau. You served as director of the network's news and information department. Yeah. How did you begin hosting ATC, and why was that the right fit for you?
I began hosting ATC the year when our two hosts left, and I had for 4 years been running NPR. Before that, I'd always worked on the air, and I had been in management for 4 years after a peculiarly bad financial crisis that we'd had, and felt that we'd pretty well patched that together, and I'd served my sentence. It was my view, and there were times when I felt that, boy, you know, if I were hosting a, the first thing I did at NPR was host a little 8-minute program, and I felt that. But I would ask that question differently. I wouldn't ask that. Here's what I would ask. I would think these things. And as news director, I would talk to the producers. And finally, I was encouraged by a colleague who said, you should do it. You should apply for the job. And the thought of not being in management anymore was just I was ecstatic about that idea. And my superiors welcomed my application. So I ascended for the second time in my life to Radio Heaven. The job that I had in London, I thought, was the highest level of paradise I would reach. But hosting ATC was just as good and a lot longer.
Yeah. Robert, I don't think there's any question that you could continue in your hosting role for a while. You still sound great on the air. But why do you think this is the time for you to retire?
I feel that it's a choice. I'm not... being wheeled out of the anchor chair. And I'd like to see what happens in the next phase of my life, whether that's doing something creative or interesting or just being a grandfather. And I like doing it while I'm still, you know, quite healthy and feeling positive about life. So I've been thinking about it. I haven't been planning for it, to tell you the truth, but I've been thinking about it, and I relish the opportunity to be unassigned and on no deadline, and not have to be at any desk come the second week in January.
Longtime All Things Considered host Robert Siegel, he's retiring after more than 40 years at NPR. Mary Louise Kelly will take over as All Things Considered host next week. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, it's a conversation with award-winning actor and IWU alum Richard Jenkins. He stars in the new film, The Shape of Water. The interview is ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Some of the relatives of Barton McNeil are in his corner as he tries to gain reconsideration of his murder conviction in the killing of his three-year-old daughter, Christina. Journalists Willis Kern Scott Reeder have the next episode of the GLT podcast, Suspect Convictions, and talk with McNeil's cousins who have been investigating the case.
The following contains graphic discussions of murder and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised.
I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911, what's your emergency?
I need an ambulance. My daughter's dying, I think.
Rescue is needed. Three-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
Wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern with investigative journalist Scott Reeder. Today it's the story of two cousins who came to the assistance of another cousin. Grace Schlaffer is Barton McNeil's first cousin once removed. Chris Ross also is Bart's cousin. Grace lives in Indiana and Chris in California. And Bart, of course, is incarcerated in Illinois. It has become Grace and Ross's quest to free Bart, who they believe was wrongly convicted. In our culture, cousins are often relegated to little more than a supporting role. This wasn't always the case. Back in the 1960s, a popular sitcom was The Patty Duke Show, about two mismatched cousins.
Do you think 30 sandwiches will be enough?
No, there are going to be 8 of us. Do you know? This is my very first slumber party.
You've lived in Europe too long, cousin. It's time you got acquainted with some of our swinging American cousins.
Have been shows about country cousins. There's Bo Duke and Daisy on the Dukes of Hazzard.
Just a good old boy, never meaning no harm. Be told you never saw, been in trouble with the law since the day they was born.
And Jethro and Ellie Mae on the Beverly Hillbillies.
Listen to my story about a man named Jed. A poor mountaineer barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food. And up through the ground come a bubbling crude. Oil, that is. Black gold. Texas tea.
But what about someone trying to get a cousin cleared of murder? Well, there's my cousin Vinny.
A funny thing happened to William and Stanley. On their way to college, they got framed for murder.
Whoa! We need to call an attorney, a great attorney.
He's not your typical hero.
We got an attorney in the family.
Great, who?
He's
my cousin Vinny.
But in the case of Barton McNeil, Grace and Chris have interviewed witnesses, pored over documents, questioned detectives, and been instrumental in getting the Illinois Innocence Project involved in the case. Barton McNeil's attorney Gwen Jordan contends they are the dynamic duo.
Grace and Chris are fabulous advocates for Bart. It's unusual the amount of work that they've put into gathering evidence, following up on leads, doing investigations, in addition to providing Bart with, you know, the much needed support. There are other family members that have stood by their loved ones that are wrongfully imprisoned and been advocates for them. It's not completely unusual, but they absolutely have gone above and beyond because they truly believe that Bart is innocent.
For Grace Schlaffer, her involvement in the case began in the middle of the night on a porch in Colorado.
Bart's mother is my first cousin, and she passed away when Bart was just very young. His grandma is my aunt. So my father and his grandpa were brothers. My mother passed away in 95, and my dad came to live with me. And one of the things that my siblings, we all got together and bought Dad a bunch of airline tickets so he could travel and see people. And one of the people were his brother's wife in Colorado. We were spending the night in her place, and in the middle of the night, she woke me up and asked me to come sit out on the porch and talk with her. And I did, and she told me the story about Bart. I did not know when I went down there about Bart. And the only reason she told me is at the time, I had been dating an attorney for several years.
Grace's boyfriend at the time didn't practice criminal law and wasn't licensed to practice in Illinois, so he wasn't able to assist with the case. But Grace became intrigued. Before sitting on the porch with Bart's grandmother, Grace was unaware of McNeil.
She asked me if she could write him and give him my phone number to contact me. And a few weeks later, I got a letter from him, a long letter. Bart knows exactly how many pages is one stamp worth.
Bart says Grace was his lifeline to the free world.
My grandmother was the one person that had this innate recognition of my innocence, sort of started the wheels in motion and advised me to contact Grace. So I wrote Grace a letter, and she wrote back right away and was real receptive to anything I had to say and sort of volunteered to help. And from there, I put her to work. I had her do a whole bunch of things. She went to the courthouse, made photocopies of all of my court records, photocopied a ton of other stuff, paid for a typewriter for me to use in the prison to type up my appeals, made phone calls, sent emails, contacted DNA experts, contacted a lot of these innocence organizations, and so forth. So she was very active on my behalf, spent a lot of time and a little bit of money, come down here to the prison and visited me a couple of times, which was the first time that I met her, brought her elderly father along, and she worked pretty hard for probably 2 or 3 years.
Grace is a sweet older lady who has worked a variety of jobs over the years. At the time she began investigating Bart's case, she was the primary caregiver for her father, who lived to be 98 years old. Often, Grace would take her father with her as she conducted her investigations.
Sometimes once a week, every week of the month. I was retired. I didn't have anything that great pressing me at the time. It all fell together pretty easily.
How far is it between Indianapolis and Bloomington, Illinois?
I think 3 hours, maybe.
You were getting out on the road for 6 hours round trip to drive to Bloomington with your dad, who was in his 90s? Man, that's a real commitment.
My dad walked for 2 miles every day till he died. My dad was a bill of health. I spent a lot of time in the courthouse. Back then, you couldn't take pictures. I can go to a courthouse now and just take my cell phone and take pictures of the documents. Before, I had to clip a paper clip on them, and then they'd go through and do it, and then I'd have to pay them for it, and it was expensive. I also talked to court reporters that did some of the hearings and stuff, and they sent me transcripts. I met with the neighbor, Susan. She contacted me one day on Facebook. The neighbors always told me that they thought Masuk was going to do something because he moved over there, and they knew it, to get away from her. And she would be constantly over there pounding on the door, yelling at him to let her in, and he wouldn't let her in. So I was surprised to hear that she was ever even in the apartment.
Grace believes in Bart's innocence, but is not blind to Bart's shortcomings.
Listening to the 911 call, does that sound like somebody who just murdered his kid? Do I think Bart was a precious little soul? He was just like the rest of us. We all have our evil thoughts and doings. And I don't mean evil thoughts of murder, but I mean evil desires like other women. Do I think he was right in going with Masuk in the first place? No. I think loyalty to your wife is what you vow to, and I'm not for that. So did he look otherwise? Yes. And was he wrong? In my opinion, yes. You don't just all of a sudden one day love somebody else. You don't turn off love that easy.
As time went on, Bart noted that Grace spent less time on the case.
After a while, she began to get discouraged at the lack of results and sort of fell off for a while. She did a lot of the advanced work that made things a lot easier.
Grace acknowledges her discouragement, but says it is not because she stopped believing in her cousin's innocence.
I had 3 strokes. It has impaired my short-term memory. And I kept finding myself not getting my work done, even though I thought I had done it.
Grace reached out to Bart's cousin, Chris Ross, in California, and asked him to take the lead in advocating for Bart.
And I finally just said, Chris, you're going to have to take over this. And Chris was so much younger and more knowledgeable on getting information. I could call people, so he's had me always calling people and taking notes. And we worked it out that way. But it got to being where Chris just was spending a lot of time. He was spending too much time that was costing him financially, I thought. He didn't say that to me, but I felt that he believed in Bart so much. He just did everything he could.
This is Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern with Scott Reeder. And Scott, we're hearing from Grace Schlaffer talking about her difficulties in trying to work hard for her long-lost cousin, Barton McNeil, and get him free from prison. You had a chance actually to sit down and talk with her. You visited with her early on in our project here. What was Grace like?
Just the sweetest lady. I mean, I just was really impressed. I was out in Indianapolis for the CrimeCon convention in June, and I knew that she lived in the Indianapolis area, so I gave her a call and wanted to see if she wanted to get together for a bite to eat. And we sat down and talked, and she was at first really nervous because I don't think she's dealt with reporters very much. And I just said, hey, you know, I'm not going to take notes or anything, let's just talk. And she was just so nice and really, I would call her a spiritual person. I mean, if you were to ask me what do I think motivates Grace, I think it's her Christian faith. I think that she really thinks an injustice has been done here, and she really feels motivated by her faith to take action and do something about it.
So I take it then after that session with her that you really weren't that surprised that she would take up this interest in Barton McNeil's case after really not even know this man existed most of her life.
You know, yeah, I'm still surprised. I mean, I think she is a terrific person. I mean, a very spiritual person. But let's face it, Willis, how many people do you know that would devote many hours a week, travel extensively with their elderly father to investigate a crime involving somebody they never met? Yeah, there's a distant relationship. I mean, she is his first cousin once removed, but she didn't even know he existed. And now she's traveling all over the place, interviewing neighbors and talking to police officers who worked the case and talking to court reporters and going through piles and piles of court documents and spending a small fortune on duplication fees and everything else. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's above and beyond what most people would ever expect. I mean, could you see any of your cousins suddenly stepping forward if you had some legal trouble and investing themselves that way?
Well, I would hope so, but I could find plenty of reasons why they wouldn't or maybe why they shouldn't do that. Of course, the Barton McNeil case is a little bit different than, I guess, your average criminal thrown in jail, as we've been unfolding over these past several weeks. I want to ask you a little bit about how does Grace process the evidence against Bart. Did you get any sense about that when you were talking with her?
Yeah, the fascinating thing about this is she was gung-ho into this case, investing 40, 50 hours a week into this case before Masuk committed the murder against her mother-in-law. So lots of people have come forward and say, well, I wonder if Bart's innocent after Masuk went out, the alternate suspect in the first murder, comes forward and kills somebody else.
Which is almost like the aha moment in this whole case. Right.
But Grace was fully invested in this case for years before that happened. So I think that she genuinely believes that Bart is innocent. I mean, one thing she said was, listen to that 911 tape. Does that sound like a guilty person to you? She very much is a believer in Bart's innocence. I mean, when you talk to her, there's no room for doubt. I mean, she really believed in his innocence. So I found that intriguing that she would invest herself that much into helping somebody she'd never met. You know, Gwen Jordan is one of the attorneys that's working the case on behalf of Bart, and she has her own theories on what motivates Chris and Grace in helping their cousin.
I really believe what drives them is that there's been an injustice here to someone that they are related to, and they feel an obligation to do anything they can to help him. because he's innocent. I feel this way. I think most of the attorneys and the staff that work on innocence projects feel this way. We don't know these people, but when you find out that there's an innocent person that's in prison, and especially because these cases involve, you know, really serious crimes, so these people are in maximum security prison under just horrific conditions. I wish every prosecutor and every governor would have to go and tour a maximum security prison. And I think they would think twice about how many people they put in those institutions and for how long. It's inhumane, the way that prisoners are treated, whether they're guilty or innocent. But especially when a person's innocent, to be imprisoned in one of those horrific places, if you have any connection to that person, you will do whatever you can to get them out. Even though maybe they weren't close to Bart beforehand, they do have a connection with him, and they see this injustice. I mean, it's impossible to imagine what it's like to be innocent and to lose your liberty. And then take it a step further and see what kind of condition these people are living in. It's a place full of violence. People are raped and beat up and fear for their lives every day. And if they're innocent, how would you live with yourself if you didn't do all that you could to get them out?
For Chris Ross, Bart has brought purpose to his life.
Chris, something got you interested in this case. Why don't you tell me about that?
Well, what happened was Mazouk went on to murder again. And at that point in time, it took Bart almost a month or more to even learn that she had killed again. Fortunately, someone within the prison population informed him of this, because he had long since lost touch with Mazouk. But she went on to murder again, and right there in McLean County, of all places. So Bart found out about it, and Bart, during one of his abilities to go out to the prison yard and make phone calls, was almost miraculously able to call local radio station in Bloomington, WJBC. They answered the phone. Normally, you have to kind of have this all set up and prearranged, but he was able to, out of the blue, call them up and say, "Hey, this is Bart, and I just found out that my former girlfriend has murdered again, by strangulation, no less, and this is always the woman that I've stated had murdered my daughter, and if this doesn't show my innocence, then I don't know what does." He was able to get on the radio station, and that recording got passed around to our family, and I heard that, and I said, "This sounds like the words of an innocent man."
Your mom found out about this, and then she told you? So how exactly did all this work?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Came by way of a friend of Bart's who sent it to my second cousin. Her name is Grace. To the side of my family, I didn't even know existed.
Okay. Do you and Grace talk very much?
We do. We speak usually about every week or two. When we first started working on Bart's case, we'd almost speak daily and communicate, of course, by email as well. So we kept extraordinarily busy the first couple of years as Mazouk, you know, was convicted, and we were working with the Innocence Project to help secure Bart's freedom.
Would the Innocence Project be involved in this case at all if it wasn't for the work you and Grace have been doing?
No, I don't believe so. I think that Bart had always pleaded with many innocence organizations for many years to take up his case, and most innocence projects, they receive about 300 to 400 applications each year, so it's hard for them to sift through and sort and decide what's the case that they want to take. So I don't believe that they would have.
Many defense attorneys say one of the most trying parts of their job is dealing with family members of the accused. But Gwen Jordan says that's not the case with Chris and Grace.
I can't always give them the answers or the time that I'm sure that they would like, because I have so many other things that I have to do. But I completely understand it, and I appreciate it. And especially with Chris and Grace, I mean, they are never critical or angry. They're always calling to get an update or with an idea about, here's another possibility, something to look at. And in both cases, oftentimes they have great insights and good ideas. So I wish I had more time to be able to devote to them. But no, I completely understand and appreciate how much they care about Bart and are working towards his exoneration.
Over the years, Bart and Chris have formed a close friendship.
I spend probably at least 5 to 10 hours a week working on his behalf. And when the whole project first began, it was more about a 20 to 30 hour work week. It seemed like I would put my kids to bed around 10 o'clock, and then once they're fast asleep, work from, say, 10:30 at night until 2 a.m. in the morning sometimes.
I guess you really hadn't done anything in the way of investigating a crime before you got involved in this case. Is that right?
That's right. I really didn't spend much time watching television or CSI episodes, so I was a complete newbie. When all the case files started to come to me, I started to read, and you learn that there's things called police narratives, where a police will interview someone, and then it's up to the police, the detective, to write kind of their recounting of what was said. So as I poured through all these documents, I found them very amazing in that each and every document that I would pick up and look at, it really said to me, Bart is innocent and Mazouk is guilty, and why did they not see this? It just seemed so utterly obvious to me that Bart was innocent all along, and Mazouk was incredibly suspicious and looking guilty each step of the way. It all of a sudden kind of shattered my faith in the criminal justice system here in America, and where we all believe in justice for all. That's not the case. There's a lot of people, I think, that have been wrongfully convicted that are, you know, whiling away their years in prisons in America.
One of the things that's kind of perplexed me a little bit is it seems like you and Bart have almost become like brothers, haven't you?
Yeah, I would say so. I don't have a brother. I look forward to the day when he's free and released and will think of him as my older brother. Absolutely.
That's Chris Ross, the cousin of Barton McNeil, who has worked tirelessly over the last several months and years, really, to help free his cousin from his prison sentence. Well, Scott, Chris is someone who you speak to frequently. He's a very persistent person. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how Chris's interest in this manifests itself in your eyes.
Well, you know, I talk to Chris probably two or three times a week at least. I mean, he's very persistent. He's a strong advocate for his cousin. He always is bounding with enthusiasm when I talk to him. Like, he gets excited and he wants to talk about the case and talk about things. He's a big fan of this podcast, as a matter of fact. He listens to it and then he calls and gives me suggestions about what we could have done better and what we ought to be looking at next. And sometimes I agree with him, sometimes I don't. But he's certainly an interesting character. What's fascinating to me, though, Willis, is it seems like these two people who really didn't know each other before this case have become extraordinarily close.
Well, I would imagine so. I would imagine that if Chris is constantly talking to you on the phone, he's probably constantly talking to Barton on the phone as well.
Yeah, he is. I mean, he'll call me a lot of times after he's got off the phone with Bart and fill me in on what Bart has to say. I mean, he actually, if you can believe this, he will download this podcast off the internet, put his phone up against the computer speaker, and play it for Bart every week. So Bart listens to it. And then Bart will actually type up or a response to whatever was said by the prosecutors or give his critique and then post it on freebart.org. I mean, have Chris actually post it on freebart.org. So there's a very close relationship there. But, you know, the two seem so much alike. I mean, their personalities seem very much alike. Their temperaments seem very much alike. They talk a lot alike. Their voice patterns even are similar. So it's fascinating to me to see how much they have in common. I mean, these two folks that maybe met once or twice in their entire life.
And Chris remains optimistic that eventually Barton will get out of prison, right?
Yeah, he does. He does. And he talks about, and I said, well, what do you expect when Bart gets out? And he goes, well, I want Bart to be free. I'd love for him to come out here to California and be with me. But, you know, it's up to Bart where he's going to be. And he talks about that. He talks about, you know, this bond that's developed between the two of them. And it's very interesting.
While Chris Ross remains optimistic that Bart will eventually be a free man, Grace Schlaffer isn't so sure.
Grace, I have to ask this. This is more of a philosophical question. As helping Bart given you purpose in life?
It did at the time, and I was a very happy person. Where I've become more negative now.
Why have you become more negative?
Mistrust of the system. Not having anything in my power to do anything. No matter what I do, it didn't help Bart. other than to talk to him. I do love that man. I think he is a wonderful person. I mean, as a cousin, I love him. But I believe in his innocence. I always will. I know someday I'll know for sure, but in my mind, it's for sure. I just don't think that it could continue for 20 years without some kind of a breakdown if it wasn't true. It just can't.
Next week during Suspect Convictions, you'll hear from a prominent true crime podcaster and a prominent true crime blogger. They, like you, have been carefully digesting each episode of Suspect Convictions, and they'll talk about the evidence, the unusual situations of this case, and who they think was ultimately responsible for Christina McNeil's death. That's next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions.
Hear new episodes of Suspect Convictions every Friday on GLT Sound Ideas at noon. Learn more and hear past episodes at WGLT.org/suspectconvictions. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Every week, Bullseye features in-depth conversations with the creators of culture, the people who make the best music, films, television, books, whatever. You'll gain new insight into all-time greats like Dolly Parton, Judd Apatow, and Lily Tomlin, and you'll hear from up-and-comers you'd never have known about otherwise. It's a show about finding the good stuff in popular culture, the stuff that changes lives. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Join me tomorrow at 11 a.m. on GLT. News and ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Off and Running, striving to be Central Illinois' go-to place for all types of runners and walkers by providing top-of-the-line products and service. Free fit analysis to fine-tune running available on-site and more information available at offandrunning.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
You're listening to the theme to the new movie, The Shape of Water. IWU alum and award-winning actor Richard Jenkins has a key role in the film. The 75th Golden Globe Film Awards will air Sunday. Jenkins is a nominee for Best Supporting Actor. He's nominated for his role as a closeted gay man in the early 1960s in the fantasy adventure film The Shape of Water. Jenkins has a long career as a character actor. He had a recurring role as the deceased patriarch in the popular HBO series 6 Feet Under and received a Best Actor Oscar nomination for his performance in the 2007 film The Visitor. Jenkins met his wife, choreographer Susan Friedrich, as a student at Illinois Wesleyan. He tells GLT's Judy Valente his mentors at Wesleyan were pivotal to his acting career.
Wesleyan gave me the confidence to pursue a career as an actor. It was a perfect place for me. I came in with no experience, very little experience, and I was 21 when I left, so I wasn't very good, but a lot of that's because I was 21. What it did was it gave me the belief that maybe I could do this, and that a lot of that's responsible for that is John Spica, who was the head of the theater department there. He was very encouraging, so I credit him a lot with that feeling that I had when I left.
Were you in some of the productions there, and what was memorable to you?
Well, they were all just fun. I mean, my gosh, we had fun. I did Flea in Her Ear. I did a Flea in Her Ear, which is a French farce that I loved doing. That was a lot of fun. I did a one-act play called Fragment. Dennis Brown directed it. And Dennis Brown was 2 years older than I was. And it was my first or second real opportunity to do something interesting. And that was a ball. I remember that experience being really great.
Now, in your own career in film and television, you've been called the quintessential character actor because you don't give these big, bold, sweeping, dramatic performances. Your performances are very understated. Is that in some ways more difficult as an actor to do?
Well, it's not something you consciously think about. You don't ever think about doing something, I'm going to be big or small.
Mm.
You just try to live your life on the screen. That's what you try to do. And sometimes it can get big, and sometimes it isn't. But it's never a conscious choice to either be, you know, loud or soft, or big or bold, or big or small. That's not how one approaches it.
Do you consider yourself a character actor?
Sure.
In what way?
I play characters, and I'm an actor. I'm not sure. People perceive a character actor, meaning a person that plays a supporting role. And that's been my career, you know, except for once where I played the lead. In film, that's been my career. That was the career I always thought I would have. I was never going to be Henry Fonda, so, you know.
You mentioned that one role where you weren't the character actor, you weren't the supporting actor, and that was, of course, The Visitor, and you were nominated for an Oscar in that. Do you consider that your breakout role? It happened rather late in your career.
It was incredible. It was a fantastic experience. But I remember thinking, if this movie isn't any good, it's my fault.
Mm.
And that was. Then you start to realize why they pay Tom Hanks the money they pay him, or Meryl Streep. You know, the movie is on their back. They carry this film, and it's daunting, you know, it's daunting.
Your wonderful face I would describe as that of everybody's next-door neighbor. Has that hindered or helped your career?
It's fine, because your next-door neighbor may be a serial killer, or your next-door neighbor may be something you don't know. You know, you are what you are. That's why, you know, you look at your face. That's an odd thing for me, to look at my face in the mirror and think, you know, I think I'll be in movies. But it's what it is, you know.
Tell us a little bit about your new movie, The Shape of Water, for which you've been nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor. And there's Oscar buzz about that performance, too. You play a very sympathetic gay man. Tell me what attracted you to that role.
I loved it the first page when I read it, and I don't even know why I'm attracted to things. I look at them and go, there's something really interesting here. There's something about this guy that I really would like to find out. And I loved it immediately. I don't know if it's because he's not a fighter, if he's I love the fact that he's terrified.
He's terrified.
He's terrified, and he goes ahead and he performs this task that I won't go into, even though he's frightened to death. I love that. I love that. That, to me, is more interesting than the hero saying, he shows no fear, and I run inside, you know, I'll pull the people out of the fire. It's always more interesting when a character is frightened to do something and does it anyway.
Well, this won't be exactly a spoiler alert, but the movie is about a sea creature that is discovered by a group of people, of which your character is part, who are all sort of misfit in a way in society. They kind of all bond over this sea creature. So tell us a little bit about what that was like, filling out that character on screen.
Well, I wouldn't call them misfits. I would call them invisible. These are the people in 1962 that were invisible, that nobody paid attention to, that nobody, as I say, there were no gay people in my high school until our 35th reunion.
Right.
You could not live your life as a gay man in 1962. I'm sure some did, but very few did. So
it was a man who happened to be gay. I mean, that was just part of who he was, and he was in love. He was smitten with this young man who ran a pie shop. He was looking for love. He was lonely. He was losing his job because he was an illustrator for an ad agency, and they were starting to use pictures and photographs and not using drawings anymore. And so it was a bad time in his life. And I love the fact that Guillermo wrote it as Dutch.
Guillermo de Toro, the director.
Guillermo de Toro, the director, who is this extraordinary film director. And I just like the journey he made, the incredible arc that his character had. He went from saying, no, I won't help you, never, 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 to I'll do anything you say. I'll do anything you ask me to do. And I love that. I love that change.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm talking with Richard Jenkins, the actor who is nominated for a Golden Globe for his performance in the film The Shape of Water. Mr. Jenkins, you're now in your 70th year. What are the challenges ahead for someone in the acting profession who is entering that decade?
I don't know. I'm just entering it, so I don't know. For me to end up with this kind of a part in this film at this time in my life is a gift. I mean, it's just a gift. I appreciate it. We'll see. I've had an incredible career. I've been incredibly lucky. I'm grateful. We'll see what they had. I don't know. No idea.
You started in theater at Trinity Theater in Rhode Island. Any plans to go back to your theater roots?
Well, I go back and I direct. My wife, Sharon, who I met at Illinois Wesleyan, was a dancer and is now a choreographer, and we worked together. A couple of years ago, we did Oliver. Last year, we did Oklahoma at Trinity Rep. Yeah, I still go back and do that. I don't act on stage anymore. I've done that in years, but our friends are there. We live in Rhode Island. We live in Providence. It gave me birth as an actor. It was, and her as a choreographer too. It was integral in our growth as folks in the business.
Sounds like you like musicals.
I love musicals. I love them. And I can't sing. I danced a little in school. I did a little dancing, but I can't sing, but I love musicals. I love to take a classic musical and rethink it. And we have a wonderful cast, a company of actors here who are beautiful singers. And one of them is from Illinois Wesleyan, Rachel Warren, who has been a member of this company at Trinity for a long time. Amazing.
TV audiences remember you from the cable series 6 Feet Under, and now you're in Berlin Station. How do you like working in television, and what are some of the differences between film and television for you?
TV's faster. In episode 1, you don't know what episode 10 is going to be because they haven't written it yet. So you don't really have a complete picture of what you're doing like you do in a movie. Television is not as visual as movies. There's a great narrative arc, and TV does that brilliantly. I mean, there's some great TV. 6 Feet Under was an incredible television show. But visually, movies are sometimes more intricate. But, you know, it's kind of the same. Acting's acting. And I love doing 6 Feet Under. I love doing Berlin Station. We had a great time.
So no real preference for film over television or television over film?
I mean, it's the character and the story, and I mean, Olive Kitteridge for me was one of the highlights of my career, which was a miniseries on HBO. I just loved every second of it.
Another one that you were nominated for a Best Actor Award.
It was an extraordinary experience.
Considered one of the best TV special series in years,
yeah.
Olive Kitteridge, with Frances McDormand.
And it was Fran's baby from the beginning. She bought the rights to the book. She called me up and said, I want you to play Henry. And it was her baby. And it was so great. It was fantastic.
What will be going through your mind at the Golden Globe Awards?
You know, should I say hi to Tom Hanks? Do you think I should go over it? I don't know. I I've never been, so I have no idea what to expect.
You know, will you be nervous?
I don't know. Yeah. The Golden Globes looks like a great party. When I watch it, I would think they look like they're having a lot of fun down there.
Richard Jenkins is nominated for a Golden Globe for his latest film, which is The Shape of Water. Thanks so much for spending time with me.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
In addition to his Golden Globe nomination for The Shape of Water, Richard Jenkins is also up for a Screen Actors Guild Award for Outstanding Performance in the same film. The Screen Actors Guild Awards will be handed out January 21st. Jenkins can be seen on the cable channel Epix as well, playing a CIA station chief in the series Berlin Station. You're listening to music from The Shape of Water on Sound Ideas. Thanks for choosing WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Judy Valente, Charlie Schlenker, Willis Kern, and Scott Reeder. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas and the podcast Suspect Convictions. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is news@WGLT.org. And you can always tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.